Well, hello out there to all of you. Wow, I am up high. I'm not used to looking down on everybody, so this is a unique situation. I hope everybody has had a wonderful week, and I know it's been a very interesting week, a busy week. But I also like to thank Mrs. Martha White for the special music. I could possibly one day be brave enough to sing a song with music. But a cappella, that's pretty remarkable. And thank you. Now we have, you know, she attends in Asheville, so we have the opportunity to hear her quite a bit and quite often. So I'm glad we could share her with the Hickory congregation this afternoon. And again, thank you, Mrs. White. And thinking back about the number of years that I have gone through the Days of Unleavened Bread, I didn't calculate it up this morning, but Mom and Dad can probably tell me. How many years is this? 50, 51? I know we started attending church in 1963, so I don't know if we kept the... I think we did because they were baptized earlier than 1963, so I'm sure we kept the Days of Unleavened Bread at home. So this is maybe 52 or 53 years that we've actually kept the Days of Unleavened Bread. But in talking to a number of you here this afternoon, I think a number of us agreed that this has probably been the fastest Days of Unleavened Bread that I can remember. Because I know it was just yesterday, and we were announcing about Passover and the night to be much observed and the Days of Unleavened Bread. And here we are, what, 9 days later from Passover. And it's hard to believe that the days have come and have gone. So either all of us are extremely old, because you know that the old saying is that the older you get, the faster time flies. I'll ask the teenagers, did it seem like a busy week or a, oh, see, they're in agreement with us. So something has changed here, because the young people, this was supposed to be a very, very slow, methodical week, but it's been a very, very busy week. And as probably a number of you have already thought through the week and, you know, the lessons that we learn, I can stand up here today and I believe I have, well, we still have a couple of, well, we still have a few hours to go, but I can't remember so far this week of slipping up and eating something that I wasn't supposed to eat. There's always a chance I'll remember something. And certainly there's always a chance I'll find something later. I know a few years ago, I made it through the Days of Unleavened Bread perfectly, and that particular spring we did a great job of cleaning everything, putting everything away, got the cars cleaned, the kitchen, you name it, we cleaned it. And a week later, I was out playing golf and looking for a golf ball, and I pulled out three packages of crackers out of my golf bag, and it was sitting by the garage door the entire Feast of Unleavened Bread. So it just goes to show you, you never know until after the fact. But it has been an interesting feast. It's been a reflective feast for me in many ways. And I certainly have enjoyed these days that God gives us. And as was mentioned this morning in the sermon, it's a lot more than just eating unleavened bread. It's really learning to live our lives apart from sin. And I will tell you just a quick story to digress. I was up last week on my farm, and the young fellow that works for me, Jose, I had him helping me clean out the trucks and the tractors, because we do that every spring for the Days of Unleavened Bread, and he's done this probably 10 or 12 times. So for him, it's just part of his job, and so we're out over a period of a day, and maybe a day and a half, and we got to vacuum out, and we're vacuuming, we're pulling out stuff. I mean, we found stuff that we didn't know we had, actually, in some of the vehicles. And so we're pulling things out and throwing things away and vacuuming, going through and vacuuming everything out. And I explained to him, that, you know, for the next week, we wouldn't be eating any bread products either in the trucks or in the tractors. And of course, he's been through that before, but it's just a matter of a reminder. So I was there this past week, and on Tuesday, we were going between farms feeding the cattle, and, we decided to stop and get a snack because he loves to have a cup of coffee in the morning about 9:30, and he normally buys a snack to go with his coffee. And so I went in and just got a bottle of water because, again, the antennae are up. I'm not going to buy anything that's leavened. And he gets his cup of coffee, And he gets a cinnamon bun. And so we both are walking up to the sales desk to pay for it, because I was gonna buy his snack. And he walks up and lays everything on the counter, and he goes, "Oh, wait a minute." He goes, "We can't eat bread this week, can we?" And I said, "No, Jose, we can't eat bread in the car or the tractor this week." But I said, "You can go outside and eat it if you'd like to." And he goes, "No." He says, "I'll get something else another time." So he went back, he put it back. Now, he has no clue, because he's Catholic. He has no clue what these days mean. But it's interesting that just the example of going through that, one of these days, and one of those days may be many years in the future, but one of these days, he'll probably think back and remember that occasion where he helped de-leaven a vehicle or a tractor, and he'll put two and two together when God opens his mind. But an interesting week it has been, and a good week it has been, and I hope that all of us have certainly enjoyed these days and what they picture and what they mean. I'd like to ask all of you this afternoon, and you don't have to give me a show of hands, but how many of you have ever taken on a construction project? Again, you don't have to raise your hand. Just think about it for a moment. How many of you have ever taken on a project where you're going to remodel your house, some room in your house, bathroom, kitchen, entryway, bedroom? And you started out with great intentions, but you never made it through. You know, and I think some of you are shaking your heads, so we can all probably agree that what we've been through. But I think all of us at some point in time have started a project and we have never finished it. We've never completed it, or at least if we did, we may have reduced the scope significantly. I knew a fellow that was a good friend of mine from college when we were living in Pasadena, and he and his wife had bought a home up in La Cañada, which was a town just north of Pasadena. And I think over the next 20 years, he remodeled that home, room by room. And I remember being there on three different occasions in an 18-month period, and his kitchen was in some sort of disarray. He started with the nook and worked his way all the way around. But he finally did get it completed. And I know many of us have probably started out on a project where we have, again, with good intentions, we've gone to clean out a storage shed maybe, clean out an attic. Maybe we're going to re-landscape our lawn in some fashion. And we never can quite get through it. Well, I picked out something that would be very handy for all of us. And it's called the six phases of a project. Now, you would think that these six phases would have to do with getting a budget put together, selecting a contractor, picking out colors, etc. But I want to see if you can relate to these phases of construction or phases of a project. The first phase is enthusiasm. I'm going to tackle that bathroom. I'm going to redo the bathroom. I'm going to go down to Lowe's or Home Depot, and I'm going to get all the materials, and I'm going to jerk everything out of its place and start anew. We've probably already done that, or some of us have. The next phase is disillusionment. We get in there and we figure out, wow, this is a much bigger project than I ever dreamed it was going to be. And then the third phase is, yes, it's panic. How am I going to put this back together? Am I going to have to go out and hire an outside contractor to come and finish it? And then the fourth phase is we search for the guilty. Why did my wife let me do that? Or why didn't my brother tell me what I was getting into? And then, of course, then follows the fifth phase is punishment of the innocent. My wife has to give up the master bath for a whole year and go use a different bathroom. And then, of course, the last and final phase is praise and honor for the non-participants. So 2 years later, the project's done. Guests come over and they tell my wife what a great and beautiful kitchen she has. And I'm standing in the background thinking, I did all the work. I went through the stress. A number of years ago, we had an opportunity to go down to Jamaica for the Feast of Tabernacles. And this is several years ago. And I remember the ride from Montego Bay down to Ocho Rios, where the feast was going to be held that year. And it was an interesting trip. You know, it's a 90-minute trip down along the coast. But one of the things that really intrigued me was looking at the construction. And I kept seeing homes that were built out of block and cement, which makes kind of, you know, which makes a lot of sense when you're a tropical island. You don't have to deal with, you know, the metal and the wood and the decay that comes from the ocean breezes. But a lot of these homes were built out of cement and block. And above the first floor, you kept seeing rebar going up into the sky. And I kept thinking, what on earth is that for? And one of the folks told me later that feast that a lot of the folks in Jamaica, they save enough money to actually start construction. Their goal is to build a two-story home. But not all of them finance. Unlike America, they don't go out and buy and get a mortgage and finish the house at once. So they start, they build what they can afford, and then maybe 10 years later, they come back and take the roof off and go up another floor. But there was one particular area in the drive that the homes that had been completed, and most of them had been, were very, very nice homes. And I noticed that there was one home that was constructed out of block, and it had the rebar going all up into the sky around all the levels. It had no windows, and it had no doors on it. And you could tell that this particular structure had been sitting there for a number of years because vines were growing on it. Animals were feeding in the lawn, or what was used to be the lawn, and no further improvement had been made to that property. And so I wondered as we drove past, that home seems to be totally out of place, sitting here among homes that had been finished. And you know, with man, we are very susceptible to starting a project and never following through. We all have good intentions. All of us at one time or another have had the intention, I'm going to do such and such, and we never follow through with it. But with God, when God decides to do a work, you know, when God decided to call you and to call me, when He decides to do a work, God is faithful to complete that work. He is faithful to the end to make it happen. When God decides to do a work, God completes it. God finishes it. Turn with me, if you would, over to Philippians, in Philippians chapter 1. And I'm going to read one verse. I'm going to read from the NIV, but it's found in Philippians 1 and verse 6. Philippians 1 and verse 6. Being confident of this, that he who began a good work in you will carry it on to completion until the day of Jesus Christ. You know, that's a promise. That's a promise that we can all sleep well at night because we have it. When God decided to call you and me and to open the truth, or open our minds to His truth, when He began that work, God tells us that He's going to finish that work. In the days of unleavened bread, as we have just gone through, yes, we focus on sin and what sin does to us and looking at a life that we hopefully live apart from sin. But we know that God is the one who is grooming us. He's the one who is building us. He is the one who is engineering our process in that sense, if I can use some of the building terms. And so when God decided to open our minds and to call us and to put His Spirit with us, God tells us, I'm going to complete that. I'm going to see it through. And so we can be encouraged that it is God, it is Him who is changing us. It is He who is making us different. And I know from time to time that all of us can become very discouraged. And certainly living in the world that we live in today, it's really tough not to get discouraged. In fact, sometimes I find that I just don't even want to listen to the news. I don't want to read the news. because it is such an upside down world that we deal with that sometimes just living can be a challenge. Just going through the process of making a living, providing for our families, can be a challenge because it's the world that we're in. It's the world we have to deal with. So one of the many lessons that we can take away from the days of unleavened bread is that as God works with us, as God shows us our sins, that as long as we continue to repent and to yield to Him, then God is going to be faithful in putting in His character and His righteousness into each one of us. God is going to complete that work. And so I've titled my sermon this afternoon, When God Does a Work. When God Does a Work. And so I hope to look at God's promises this afternoon and what He assures us of as He is personally involved with each one of us and bringing us to that opportunity to have salvation and children with Jesus Christ in the God family. So hopefully as we think about what we have observed this past week and as we really take the lessons from what these days show us and as we move into the future, I think all of us clearly understand that living a sinless life is not just given to us for one week, but it is a way of life. God gives us one week to focus on it, but living apart from sin is a way of life, and God is going to provide that power and that encouragement, and He's going to give us His Spirit in order for us to accomplish it. But we have to yield. We have to be willing to repent. We have to be willing to yield to God, and it is God who is going to give us the strength and the power to complete the process. I'd like to look back now as we get into the sermon, going back to an account that's given to us back in Exodus. We're just going to look at a few areas here. And it's found over in Exodus chapter 3. And this is the account of where God is going to call Moses, or He's going to bring Moses into the picture as an instrument for taking out or helping to bring the children of Israel out of Egypt. And God was in the process of selecting Moses to be His workman, to be His tool, to be His instrument. And God had decided that it was time to bring Israel out of captivity. Here a nation had been held captive in Egypt for over 400 years. You know, and sometimes we read that and we don't really think about what that means. But you know, 400 years is almost twice the time that the United States has been a nation. So generations of Israelites had been born and had died in Egypt. And they had become a great nation. And their cries went up to God, and God no doubt heard their cries for many years. But God was going to, at this particular time, God was going to free the nation of Israel from Egypt. And we know that Egypt is symbolic of sin. And so God, in the same way that He was going to bring Israel out of sin, also, or bring Israel out of Egypt, also brings each one of us out of sin. But in Exodus chapter 3, and let's pick up the story in verse 7. Exodus chapter 3, beginning in verse 7. And the Eternal said, I have surely seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt, and I have heard their cry because of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. And this wasn't the only moment in time that God had heard their pleas, had heard their cries. He was certainly well aware of their plight. And we don't know why God allowed them to be in Egypt for 400 years, but it was a prophecy that He gave to Abraham that that would occur. But it was time to deliver them, and it was time to set them free. And during the 400 years, He had prospered them, and they had grown into an enormous multitude of people. And now He was going to fulfill that promise to Abraham, and He was going to now make them into their own great nation. And He was going to give them a promised land. And so verse 8, as we continue with this particular section, and God is talking to Moses here, He said, So I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up from that land to a good and large land, to a land flowing with milk and honey. And we see from verse 8 that God is the one that's going to do it. You know, Moses was the instrument, but it is God who said that I am going to deliver them. I'm going to get involved now. But verse 10, come now, therefore, and I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. But then Moses said to God, well, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should be the one to bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? And so we can see Moses as here he is at this particular stage or state in his life, asking God, why send me, God? What if they decide not to believe me? What if I go there and they refuse to acknowledge me or to hear your words? And so God begins to work with Moses. He's already speaking to him, by the way, through this miracle of a burning bush. And God begins to work with Moses. And as we move into chapter 4, God performs two miracles right there for Moses. He tells Moses to throw down his staff, and God turns it into a serpent. And he tells Moses, take it by the tail and pick it up. And he did. And then he tells Moses, he says, to take your hand and put it into your breast, or we would say put it into our coat pocket or into our jacket pocket. He pulls the hand out, and it's leprous. And then he tells him, put it back in. And so he put it back in, hand comes out, and it's made perfect and healthy again. And so God is revealing himself here to Moses, showing Moses his power and his commitment. But Moses still isn't convinced, is he? Moses still questions God about, are you really going to do this? Is this really going to occur? And probably we can look at this particular account and we realize and we see that here Moses in this particular point in his life, in his particular process of being converted and in this particular time of in his life with his relationship with God, maybe he was a little bit immature in terms of his faith. Maybe he was weak in terms of his faith. But God is still working with him, and God just revealed to him the power that he possessed through the miracles that Moses was able to witness. And then dropping down to verse 10 of Exodus chapter 4, then Moses said to the Eternal, O my Lord, I am not eloquent, neither before nor since you have spoken to your servant, but I am slow of speech and slow of tongue. You know, Moses was telling him, God, I just am not that good of a speaker. I'm uncomfortable going before an audience. I was that way before I met you. I'm still that way after you've started to deal with me. And then God asked him, he says, so the Eternal said to him in verse 11, well, who has made man's mouth? Or who makes the mute, the deaf, the seeing, or the blind? Have not I, the Eternal? You know, God is working directly with Moses. He wants Moses to see and to have faith and trust in what God is able to do. Verse 12, now therefore go, and I will be with your mouth, and I will teach you what you shall say. And we would think, you know, from a human perspective, again, none of us were there, but having seen at least these three miracles, the burning bush, the staff turned into a snake, the leprous hand, and then the immediate healing, how many of us would have said, I'm ready to go. I'm committed. I'm strong. Let's go for it. Moses still wasn't quite there, was he? Verse 13. But he answered God and he said, O my Lord, please send by the hand of whomever else that you may send. You know, here God had revealed to Moses his intention, his power, told Moses what he was going to do. And yet we see that Moses' trust and faith in God was still just a little bit weak. Wasn't quite there yet. Why was he weak in believing that God would not do what God promised or said he would do? And so as we think about what God is doing for each one of us, we should all ask ourselves a personal question. Do I ever have a little bit of Moses in me? Do I ever find that I have a little bit of Moses? Not quite ready to trust God. Not quite ready to give over my full confidence in following God. Not quite sure that God is really going to complete what he says he's going to do. And it's interesting that as we mature in our faith, that God gives us the strength. But here we see that Moses was not quite yet ready to trust God. And so as we think about what God is doing for each one of us, and as we think about living a life that is free from sin, do we personally trust God that he is going to give us the necessary power to change? Do we trust that God is going to be able to make us stronger and to make us a more perfect servant for he and Jesus Christ? Do we have that strength and do we have that faith? Let's look at an example that's a little bit later, actually quite a bit later in Moses' life. And look how his faith and his strength has grown. Let's turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 31. Over in Deuteronomy chapter 31. This is at the end of Moses' life. God has told him that he's not going to go into the promised land and that Joshua would be the one that was going to lead Israel into the promised land. And Moses is going to raise up Joshua. Or actually, I should say God is going to raise up Joshua. And he instructs Moses that Joshua is going to be the one. But beginning in verse 7 of Deuteronomy chapter 31, it says, "Then Moses called Joshua and said to him in the sight of all Israel, 'Be strong and be of good courage, for you must go with this people to the land which the Lord has sworn to their fathers to give them, and you shall cause them to inherit it.'" Now look at the attitude and the confidence that Moses has here in verse 8. And he continues with Joshua and he says, "And the Eternal, he is the one who goes before you. He will be with you. He will not leave you nor forsake you. Do not fear or be dismayed." You know, Moses' faith and his trust in God was much, much greater at the end of his life. And that same description of what God is going to do or did do with ancient Israel is certainly applicable to each one of us. That God is not going to leave us. He's not going to give up on us. He's going to commit, or he's going to finish what he has committed in working with us. That he is going to bring us to perfection. And hopefully as we think through these days and what they picture, that we can have the confidence in allowing God to put his righteousness in us and that we can live apart from sin. There is another interesting comment that's recorded in Esther that shows the power of God that I'd like to look at real quickly. It's found over in Esther chapter 6. It's probably not a book that we go there very often, or at least I don't. But to give you the context of what is said here in Esther 6 verses 12 and 13, God is working to protect Mordecai and the Jews at this particular time in the Persian Empire. And at the beginning of chapter 6, the king is having a restless night's sleep. So when you and I find ourselves in that situation, we might get up and turn on the TV or maybe turn on their laptop and read something on the internet. But the king is tossing back and forth in bed, can't sleep, and so he calls for the servants to bring him the Chronicles of the Persians and the Medes. And he wants somebody to read to him. And so they begin to read. And he comes across a particular passage in this history book that named Mordecai as being an individual who really saved the king from an assassination plot. And the king stops the one who was reading to him and he says, "Well, what did we do to honor Mordecai?" And the individual said, "Well, we didn't do anything." And he says, "Well, we should honor Mordecai." Now, at this point in time, Haman is wanting to act on this evil deed of having the Jews killed. And a decree has already been made by the king. And so Haman is very subtle and very deceptive in that sense. And so the king asked Haman to come in, and he asked Haman, he said, what should the king do to honor someone who has shown tremendous loyalty and favor to the king? And of course, Haman thought he was talking about him. So, you know, the chest comes up, and this is my opportunity, he thinks in his heart. Wow, this is my opportunity to really tell the king what I'd like. And so he says, well, this particular man, if you really want to honor him, you need to give him one of your robes and put it on him. You need to put him on one of the king's stallions and decorate the stallion. And then you need to parade him around the city and have people honor him. And of course, the whole time, Haman was thinking, well, that's going to be me. And so the king told him, he says, you speak well. Now I want you to do everything that you said to Mordecai. You know, God does have a sense of humor. That's one place that proves that. And so Haman is mortified, but he does it. He takes Mordecai through the city. He does everything that he told the king that should happen. And then let's pick up the story here in verse 12. And after this parade had finished, Mordecai went back to the king's gate, but Haman hurried to his house, mourning with his head covered. You know, it had to be a terribly embarrassing day for him because a number of people knew that he disliked Mordecai and was out to do away with Mordecai. In verse 13, when Haman told his wife Zeresh and all of his friends everything that had happened to him, his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, if Mordecai, before you have begun to fall, if he is of Jewish descent, you will not prevail against him, but you will surely fall before him. Now, they knew that God was with Mordecai. And so if God is with us, how can we fail? If God is with us, how can we fail from reaching that promised land, that spiritual promised land? And obviously the Persians must have been aware of the miracles that God did in Egypt and the other miracles that he continued to do with the nation of Israel when he brought them out of Egypt. And so they were aware of the power of God and that when God decided to do a work, no one was going to get in the way. Now let's turn over to John chapter 15. In John chapter 15. Most of us read this on Passover evening, but I'm going to read from the from the NIV, John 15, and beginning in verse 4. Remain in me, and I will remain in you. And these are great comforting words that Christ left with his disciples. He said that no branch can bear fruit by itself, but it must remain in the vine. Neither can you bear fruit unless you remain in me. And then in verse 5, he says, I am the vine, and you are the branches. And if a man remains in me, and I in him, he will bear much fruit. And apart from me, you can do nothing. And again, I won't ask for a show of hands, but I know all of us at one point in time in our life, we've probably reached up and separated ourselves from the vine, and we've tried to do it all on our own. And here we see God's encouraging words that apart from Jesus Christ, apart from God living in us, that we can do nothing. And so here we see as God is promising us that if we can do nothing apart from him, then certainly we can do much if we are part of him. Because God says that there is nothing impossible with him. And so we're to remain attached to the vine. That we're to remain dedicated, yielding to God so that Jesus Christ and God will live in us, will dwell with us, and will continue to build that spiritual temple. Now let's go back to Philippians chapter 2. to Philippians chapter 2. And beginning in verse 13, and I'm going to read this from the New Living Translation because I like the way it brings out this particular section of Scripture. But in Philippians chapter 2 and beginning in verse 13, it says, "For God is working in you, giving you the desire to obey Him and the power to do what pleases Him." And so here we see very clearly that it is God who gives us the desire, and it is God who gives us the power. It comes from Him. Our part is to yield and to do what we do with God working in us. And so here God gives us the desire and the power to walk away from sin and to live according to His laws. And then going on in verse 14, Paul tells us, "Stay away from complaining and arguing so that no one can speak a word of blame against you. You are to live clean, innocent lives as children of God in a dark world full of crooked and perverse people." And then he says, "Let your lives shine brightly before them." I think the King James says, "Let your light." Well, that light is based on how we live our life. Let your lives shine brightly before them. And so each year, as we're able to keep these feast days, I hope that they open up more and more meaning to each one of us. I hope that, as we said earlier, that even though this seemed like a very, very fast week, that I certainly hope that all of us have been successful in taking more time, more personal time, to meditate and to pray and to focus on what God is doing for us, putting our eyes into His words, reading, and really giving a lot of thought about how God is building us, how God is creating us into a new being, into a new creation. I can think back, I guess it's been now 8 years ago, when we were building our home that we live in today. And this may not be an exact analogy, but it kind of brings out the thought that I would like to share with you. I remember going to where our home was going to be built. And it was a raw acre in a forested area, just trees on it. And we were told that this process was going to take basically a year from beginning to end. And over the next 2 months, I saw the trees come down, the basement was dug, the foundation went in, the house starts coming up out of the ground, the framing comes on, the roof goes on, the windows go on, the doors go on, the siding goes on. You know, this house is really starting to look good. This is about 3 or 4 months into the project. And then I remember going out, and I would go out, and I couldn't see anything happening for a week at a time, or 2 weeks. And as I thought through this, isn't our process as a Christian a lot like this? Is that when God calls us and opens our mind, there is a tremendous amount of change at the beginning. In fact, there's a lot of change as God is dealing with us. And then as we're baptized and God gives us His Spirit, there is a lot of change. And we probably can see that. And certainly others can see that. But with this house, now for a period of probably 9 months, every time I would drive up to the house, nothing's changed. But what was happening is when you go through the front door, 3 months into the project, now the plumbing's going in, now the electrical's going in, sheetrock, insulation, light switches, molding, flooring, tile. Everything is being created now from the inside. And the inside is being made beautiful. And so from the outside, I couldn't see that much was going on. But from the inside, a lot was going on. And 4 months into the project, the curb appeal of my home was fantastic. But the moment you walk through the front door, no thank you. And that's that way now when we look at real estate. You know, all the realtors talk about curb appeal and, you know, we put the fresh coat of paint on and so forth. But I can guarantee you, if you love a house from the outside and you walk through the front door and it's in disarray, what happens to your enthusiasm? It's just like deflating a balloon, isn't it? But over that period of a year, I saw the house take shape from the inside out. And once the inside was completed, you walk through the front door, it was beautiful. And then the final touches go on to the outside. And I know the analogy breaks down, but through our process of being brought into perfection, you know, a lot of that is very similar to how what we go through as Christians. There's a lot of change that's recognizable at the very beginning. And then I think there's several years where we even sometimes question ourselves. Am I in a fog? Am I really growing? Can people see that I'm growing? Do I feel like I'm growing? And yet the whole time, God is inside there. You know, if we could pull open our chest, our mind, and we could see God working, we would see what I'll call the plumbing and the electricity going in. God is perfecting us. God is bringing that whole process to fruition. Because he tells us that he's building us into his holy temple. And I know the analogy breaks down, but certainly that is what God is doing. And it's interesting to think about how that occurs. Is that for a period of time, it doesn't seem like that maybe that there's lots and lots of growth going on from our perspective, but inside and with God, there is a lot of growth going on. There is a lot of character being formed. And little by little, we're getting rid of our unrighteous thoughts and putting the righteous thoughts in. So hopefully as we keep this feast each year, that we can spend more and more time meditating and asking God, show us where we still need help, but thank you so much for what you've done so far. And we realize that it's not by our might. It's not by our skill. It's not by our own power. It's really God's power that is making that change. You know, a good friend of mine, another story pops into my mind, a good friend of mine, I had a chance to meet his father. Well, this is probably 30 years ago. And his father was 50 years old at the time, maybe 55. But his father, for 23 years, drank a case of beer a day. And I'm not exaggerating. He drank a case of beer a day. You do the math. I think it was 23 years. 22 or 23 years. And from the time he got up in the morning until the time he went to bed, a beer was never more than an arm's reach from him. And so on this particular day, I'd met him once before, but on this particular day, we were playing golf out in Southern California. And for the first half hour, maybe it was a little bit humorous because he had had a few beers at that point in time. But after a couple of hours, it became very, very weighty and very, very annoying. And I remember being really put out by his activity and by his demeanor. And it wasn't but a few years later, maybe less than 3 or 4 years later, now that I think about it, that he went to the doctor to have a checkup because he was having some health issues. Now, drinking, you know, 23 cases, I mean, a case of beer for 23 years, you would think you'd have lots of health issues. But it was something was bothering him and he wanted to have a doctor look at him. And so he went in for this particular appointment and he had some tests run. And then a week later he went back and the doctor told him, he says, look, I don't need to talk to you about anything that we have discovered here, but I can give you one piece of advice. He said, if you don't stop drinking, he said, in less than 6 months, we will bury you. That's how bad his liver and his health had become. Now, he was around 55 years old when he had that meeting with the doctor. And he's never had another beer since the day he walked out of that office. And he's 80 years old. Now, we all have willpower. And we can make changes like that. You know, we can give up drinking, we can quit smoking, because we do have willpower. But if you will talk to him, which most of you won't have a chance to do, but he will tell you, I can't think about having a beer, and I certainly can't take one sip of a beer, or I would relapse. And what's interesting is, I relate that story to you, that, you know, as humans, we do have willpower. And we can muster up enough willpower sometimes to make some significant changes in our life. But there is a big difference between the change that our willpower drives and the change that God's power and spirit drives. Because God changes us at the heart. God changes our motivation. He changes our desires. He changes the way we think. And when that change occurs with the godly formula, those changes can become perfect and the desire goes away. And so when we think about overcoming sin and we look at sin that God helps us to overcome, and I'm certainly sure that all of us have had a moment or two where we thought we've battled something, we've won, and something along the lines will slip up and we fall back in and we're sorry and we repent. But the motivation to change is there. And we certainly ask God for His sacrifice and the blood that was spilled by Jesus Christ to forgive us. But when God changes us and when God does His work, He's changing the heart, the mind, the way we think, and the way we conduct ourselves. Let's turn over to Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12. And beginning in verse 1, Hebrews 12 and beginning in verse 1, he says, "Therefore we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and the finisher of our faith." And I know as we think through these days and as we look at the days ahead, that there are often times where we do fall to the subtleties of sin, and we will ask God to forgive us and that we move forward. And certainly Paul understood this too, that sins that we think we've overcome, sometimes they show up again. And Paul certainly understood it. We all understand it, but we also know that God is going to forgive us as long as we're yielding and repenting and continuing to strengthen the character so that eventually those sins go away. Paul knew that Christ was going to fight for us. He knew that as long as we were human, that we would be susceptible to sin. But he also knew that Christ was victorious over sin and that Christ living in us would help us to become that perfect servant of God in Jesus Christ. Let's turn to Philippians chapter 3. In Philippians chapter 3, and let's begin in verse 12. Philippians 3 and beginning in verse 12. "Not that I have already attained or am already perfected, but I press on that I may lay hold of that for which Christ Jesus has also laid hold of me." You know, Paul knew he wasn't perfect. Paul knew he had sin that he had to battle, and he knew he wasn't perfect, but Paul was compelled to live his life according to the life that Jesus Christ showed him. And that expectation is for us as well, that while we're not perfect, we're going to rely on Jesus Christ to give us the strength and the focus to walk and to overcome. And then in verse 13, Paul goes on to say, "Brethren, I do not count myself to have apprehended, but one thing I do, forgetting those things which are behind." So he wasn't going to dwell on what mistakes he'd made in the past. Certainly he was going to repent of those, but he understood the sacrifice that Jesus made on his behalf and the blood that was able to take away those sins. And so he said he wasn't going to look at the past in the sense that he wasn't going to dwell on that. He wasn't going to be depressed by that, but he was going to press forward. And reaching forward to those things which are ahead, verse 14, "I press toward the goal for the prize of the upward call of God in Jesus Christ." So when God decides to do a work with us, God is going to see that work completed and finished. And he's going to take us to the point of perfection, and he's going to give us that crown of salvation that we have been promised. In 1 Peter chapter 1 and in verse 4, in 1 Peter 1 and verse 4, and I'm going to read from the New Living Translation. 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 4. For God has reserved a priceless inheritance for his children. It is kept in heaven for you, pure and undefiled, beyond the reach of change and decay. Verse 5. And God in his mighty power will protect you until you receive this salvation because you trust in him. It will be revealed on the last day for all to see. And then in verse 6, so be truly glad, rejoice. There is ahead wonderful joy, even though it is necessary for you to endure many trials for a while. You know, yes, we are in a period of time where we're growing and we are all going to endure trials. But here, Peter is showing us that our focus is on the prize, on the promise that God has given to us. And the joy when we receive that prize, the joy when we are there, is going to be beyond what any of us can comprehend. You know, Paul said, eye has not seen. And certainly we can have a glimpse of it in our imagination, but the reality of it is going to be so, so much better. And so we do look forward to that time. We do look forward to that opportunity. We do look forward to the fulfillment of that promise and to really be in a joyful, joyful state. You know, a good friend of mine was telling me that this past summer he and his wife had an opportunity to go down to visit some temple ruins in Mexico. And I believe it was in July of last year. And this particular day it was pouring down rain and they were going through the tours. And she was wearing a pair of diamond earrings that he had given her for her 25th wedding anniversary. So you can imagine, ladies, these were very, very special. They were very special to her, and there was tons and tons of sentimental value to them. And as they were leaving the final tour that day, it was pouring. I mean, the expression of raining cats and dogs, that was truly it. And they were parked in a dirt parking lot, and there were several cars there. And they each had a sweatshirt on, and he had a jacket on. And so it was about a 200-yard run from the last tour to the car. And so they both ran. And right before they got into the car, they took off their outer garments so they didn't have to ride home in wet clothes. And the ride home was about 60 miles. And his wife had on a sweatshirt, and it was soaked. And so how do you take a sweatshirt off? You grab the bottom of it, and you jerk it over your head. That's what she did, jumped in the car, and they drove back to the hotel. When she got to the hotel, she happened to look in the mirror, and the right earring was missing. And she was distraught. She was in tears. She was upset. She went to go right back at that moment and to see if she could find that earring. And of course, her husband said, honey, there is no way that we can go back. The roads are washed out at this point in time. It's dark. We'd never be able to find it. I'll just buy you another one. No, 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 no. You're not going to buy me another one. I want that earring back. And so she couldn't sleep that night. She actually got up and prayed several times that God would help her find it. Her husband had promised her the night before, okay, we'll go back. But in his mind, he's thinking, I'm going to drive an hour all the way back down, an hour all the way back, maybe an hour looking for this. We're never going to find it. But I got to do it to keep peace. And so 5 o'clock in the morning, way before daylight, she's punching on him. Let's go. Let's go. Let's go. So they jump in the car and they drive 60 miles back to where their last tour was located. In the meantime, during the night, the rains had washed out the road in two places and they had to go on a couple of detours. So what would normally have taken about an hour and 15 minutes was a 2-hour trip. And they got back to the parking lot just about a half hour after the sun had come up. Nobody was there. A few pools of water scattered around. But the proverbial looking for a needle in the haystack, that was their challenge. And he remembered pretty much where they had parked. And so the feeling was if they could get back to that spot, then they would really comb through the sand looking for this earring. And so he got close, parked the car, and before he turned the engine off, she screamed, threw the door open, ran outside, and about 10 feet away, glistening in the sand, was a diamond earring. And she cried and she cried and she cried. She was overwhelmed with joy that she found this earring. Now that was a physical piece of jewelry. How are we all going to feel when God gives us that crown of glory? I imagine there's going to be lots and lots of crying and jubilation. Because Peter says here, be glad, rejoice. There is wonderful joy ahead. Let's finish by turning to Hebrews chapter 13. In Hebrews chapter 13. And beginning in verse 20. Hebrews 13, beginning in verse 20. Now may the God of peace, who brought up our Lord Jesus from the dead, that great shepherd of the sheep, through the blood of the everlasting covenant, make you complete in every good work to do his will, working in you what is well-pleasing in his sight, through Jesus Christ, to whom be the glory forever and ever. Here we see that it is God the Father and Jesus Christ working in us to do their will. When God does a work, he will complete it. This season certainly pictures all of us living a life free from sin, but it requires us to yield to God each and every day. These days picture a relationship with God that is free from sin, even though we do from time to time we will slip up. And we certainly ask that Christ live in us and that he help in our walk and that he builds his character in us. So hopefully we all have faith and the confidence that this new creation that God is building within us, perfecting us, bringing us into that holy temple. I hope all of us have the faith and confidence to trust God that when God does a work, God completes that work.